Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today as we begin our program by taking a look at science, kind of a monthly look that we take with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. He also directs the Initiative for Science Literacy here in the state. So really pleased to have him back. And certainly if you have some science questions on your mind, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890, and you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Bassam, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
It's always nice to be with you, Larry.
Last night, you and your colleagues from the Wisconsin Society for Science Literacy were part of an outdoor event in Madison, which was pretty cool. Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra played. Fireworks.
Yes.
And Andrew Sewell, of course, was the maestro for the event. And sort of an interesting mix of science and music and fireworks.
That's a fabulous mix, Larry, and I was very pleased that the Gilamas Company that hosted this event invited the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy to participate. And the program started at 7 o'clock with the orchestra playing, of course, followed by the fireworks. But before the orchestra played, I and my colleagues discussed and displayed demonstrations that related to the science of fireworks. But we also had some hands-on experiments that kids of all ages really enjoyed. And I brought just a couple of them with me here today. Maybe you can give us a play-by-play description of what we have here.
Yeah, you've got four beakers, I guess we could call them. Two of them look like they have a clear liquid, and then there's one that's kind of purplish, I would say, and another one sort of reddish in
it. Yes, yes. And so what I'm going to do now is put my goggles on, because into the beakers that have the reddish and purplish liquids, I'm going to take some dry ice, which is solid carbon dioxide, and just drop it in there. And now you can
Bubbling up. And, and they're changing color. The colors are going to clear.
What's changing color?
The red is changed to clear, I believe, and the looks like
Colorless.
Colorless.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And
the color purple, of the liquid changed,
yeah,
right?
The purple changed to yellowish.
Kind of yellow, yeah, yeah. That's because carbon dioxide gas is coming from the sublimation of the dry ice, and it combines with the water to give us carbonic acid. And these cylinders had in them dyes that change color as the acidity of the liquid changes. And the bubbling is coming from the sublimation process, of course. You know, Larry, in my right hand here, I'm holding a chunk of dry ice, but you don't see any bubbles. That's because the sublimation is still taking place, but carbon dioxide is mixing with air. You can't see it. Now with the liquid, you can see it. So this was one of the interesting experiments, and maybe if we listen carefully, you can hear the bubbling on the... Can you...
Yeah, I think we can. hear that.
Yeah. Now the other two round bottom flasks that we have also have in them clear and colorless liquids, and I'd like you to pick one up. Pick it up, and put your thumb on top of the rubber stopper,
okay,
and just shake it a little bit. And now tell us what you see.
Oh, so it's changing from a clear liquid to a pink.
What about mine?
Yours is you're doing the same thing on yours, and yours is changing to blue.
Exactly. And so that's the fascination that we all have with color changes. And we used those last evening at the concert in the park to have people ask questions and be fascinated. And I tell you, the facial expressions were just fabulous, just like yours now, Larry.
And that's great.
So the mix of science and arts is something that's very dear to our heart at the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy, because we're interested in promoting creativity. We're looking at the intersection of creativity in the arts, creativity in the sciences. Do they overlap? Are they different? We want to promote young people's talents and help develop their talents, not only in science, but in all human endeavors, so that they can fulfill their human potential. And it was just wonderful to see hundreds of people last evening at the Gilamas Park, at the Gilamas Company Business Park, enjoying both the music and the signs that we did. And the fireworks were just really fabulous. And on our website, we have a description of the signs of the fireworks, and people can go there and visit. It's www.scifun.org. Scifun.org. And if I may, it was a very interesting event last evening because our host announced just as the concert was about to begin that he is the proud grandfather of a new grandson.
Named after him, no less. Of course. No less. Basav Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, our guest today as we talk science research, and education. I should mention that if you go online to our website right now, Al Reland of our staff, Wisconsin Public Radio staff, was just in and took a couple of pictures, and he's posted those, and you should be able to see them right now. If you go to our website, WPR.org, and then go to my part of that website, you'll see a shot of Basav with his beakers and bottles right in front of him there. So that's kind of fun. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. I was interested in a study with the Wisconsin Connection published in the Journal of Science that shows that girls and boys have roughly the same average scores on state math tests. But boys more often, either they excelled or they failed. As a teacher, what does that tell you?
This is a very important study that our colleague, Professor Janet Hyde, conducted along with other collaborators across the country. And to look at the question as to whether boys or girls differ in terms of their performance on mathematics, in mathematics. And their conclusions, Larry, clearly challenges the frequently cited argument that the poorer female performance in math explains the shortage of women in physics, engineering, and other sciences. That's been offered as an explanation. And this study that Professor Hyde and her colleagues did, they examined extensive performance assessments of more than 7 million students carried out by 10 states. And this was a requirement from the federal law, the No Child Left Behind law. Mm-hmm. They found that in standardized tests, the difference between the average math scores of boys and girls in grades 2 to 11 were statistically insignificant. Mm. This research team also studied if there were gender discrepancies at the highest levels of mathematical abilities and how well boys and girls resolved complex problems. Again, they found no significant differences. And so, you know, a stereotype that we have in our society now is being addressed by this publication in Science magazine. And I hope that not only my fellow teachers and professors, but also parents and decision makers will become familiar with this study and help us promote the development of talent of young girls and young boys alike. Clearly, the data show that there are no statistically significant differences. Now, this is not the end of all in this conversation that's been going on for a long time in our society, but this is a recent development, and all of us should be aware of the findings that Janet Hyde and her colleagues, namely that there are no statistically significant differences in mathematical performances of girls and boys on tests.
The one part of it, too, that I thought was interesting was the fact that, or the finding that boys, either they were seemed to be either very good, sort of a bimodal thing. They were either very good or they weren't very good at all. And how do you is it an instruction thing or what's going on?
Again, one has to look at the data carefully, and this is what Professor Hyde and her colleagues continue to do to really tease out of the information valid conclusions, and to also look at how many people, how many students of both genders participate in the test taking, and I suspect that the point that you raise has to do with the number of boys and the number of girls that are taking it. But all young people have a great deal of talent, and they really should not be afraid to take mathematics and science and other areas of learning too. And they're great careers waiting for them in science, engineering, and mathematics. This will be a wonderful thing for parents and teachers to learn about and to really nurture the development of their children.
Well, every one of our lines is filled, so let's take some calls here. And Stanley in Augusta is up first, so let's go there. Hi, Stanley. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. The last time I heard Sam on the radio, he was speaking to the school schedule that we have, and he hypothesized that the reason for the school schedule with the summers off and the arrangement the way it was the demands of agriculture, and I don't agree with his hypothesis. I think he doesn't understand the situation, possibly, or hasn't done the research. If the school schedule was going to be dictated by the demands of agriculture, students wouldn't go in the early spring during planting and in the late fall during harvesting and would go during the summer. It is my belief that the reason for the school schedule is the demands of air conditioning and keeping the schools cool enough that the students could be in school at all. And I wonder if he would speak to that.
I'd be happy to, and thank you for listening and even thinking about issues that I raise on Larry's program. This is not an observation that I came up with by myself. This is the accepted explanation as to why we have 180 days during the school year. Because, you know, we're an agrarian society, and and the explanation was that we needed people to work in the summer more so than during the winter on the farms. Now you raise an interesting point, and I'll have to think some more about it and see if it relates to the observation, but. You know, there isn't anything really magical about going to school for only 180 days a year. There are many colleges and universities that have trimesters, and of course, most universities have summer school, an accelerated version of what goes on during the semester. The 16-week semester is covered in 8 weeks. So learning takes place year-round. Formal classroom instruction, of course, is determined locally in the United States, and it is the purview of the local school districts to decide how long the school year should be and how many snow days. We talk about snow days,
right,
in where we live here, how many days for vacation and so on. So it is an interesting question in terms of, you know, how long should a student be in a formal classroom? And that's something we should look at seriously, because in other countries,
Canada, for example, goes another month longer, I believe,
right,
than we do.
Right, right. So historically, as far as I can tell, the explanation that I shared with the listening audience is the correct one. But Stanley raises another point, and if other people have other information about it, I am always happy to learn.
Thanks, Stanley, for calling. Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking science today with Bassam Shakashiri, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Luba in Madison next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, and thank you very much. I have a question, and I don't know if the basis of my question is correct. But this is about, I have the assumption that there's mercury in the new light bulbs. And when they burn out, will this be comparable to nuclear waste as environmentally unsound, or I'm stretching the analogy, but I don't feel quite comfortable about this.
Thank you for your call, and I applaud your concern. We really, as consumers and as citizens, should be very careful about the products that we use and their safe disposal when they are finished. There are new light bulbs that are coming on the market that are said to be more efficient in terms of the light that they put out. And there, in fact, some of the green approaches that we have in society call for these to be substitutes for the fluorescent light bulbs that we have. The fluorescent light bulbs are the ones that have the mercury in them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the new ones have the mercury in them, but mercury is an element. We all know about mercury thermometers and so on. In fact, mercury, Larry, is a liquid at room temperature. It's a metal. It's a liquid mm-hmm. at room temperature. That's an interesting question in itself, is how come in the sea of hard metallic elements there is mercury element number 80, which is a liquid, but that's a side question from what she's asking about. We need to keep tabs of where the mercury is in the environment, and because it causes it has serious ecological consequences. It is poisonous. It is poisonous. It is said that in Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Hatter mm-hmm. got mad because he had a mercury compound in the hat that he was wearing, and that's partly folklore, but maybe there's some truth to it or not. Mercury can be poisonous if it gets into the food chain. Fish in Wisconsin and elsewhere are susceptible to picking up mercury compounds. So that's why we have now state regulations that control mercury emission from smokestacks. Coal has in it a little bit of mercury along with the sulfur, and so when they're burned, the mercury is emitted into the air and then ends up settling in the environment and can get into the food chain. So we have to be careful about that. So I would say read the label carefully for the product that you're buying, for the new light bulbs, and mm-hmm. If you have some questions, you know, before you pay for it, just ask.
And thanks very much for calling. Roger in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Thanks very much for your excellent program. My question is also energy-related in some respect as well. I had an old 62 Thunderbird, which at the request of my kids and family, I got rid of a number of years ago. Since I changed my own oil, I had a kind of a big stock of oil. It was 1040 is API SF. Of course, now they're on probably SGA or beyond, and the oil really is kind of useless as far as cars are concerned. Do you have any suggestions as to whether I could use it for diesel fuel or besides motorcycle for lawnmowers or things like that?
My first suggestion to you, and probably my best suggestion to you, is to recycle it. And you know, go to the closest recycling center. Municipalities have information as to where you can properly dispose of such material.
Milwaukee's from Milwaukee. I mean, I know Milwaukee has a big recycling center.
I think it's very important not to just dispose of it. So that I would say if you – well, it depends how much you have of it and what else you want to – what else you might do with it. But that would be my recommendation. If there are such fluids left over from automobiles or other gasoline-containing vehicles, using vehicles, that's to dispose of them properly that way.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Roger. Bill and DePere, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thanks. Your producer indicates maybe you answered my question yesterday, but first, in chemistry, we find out that it's almost impossible to keep alcohol totally pure because it picks up air from the atmosphere any place it can get it. Two questions. Left to its devices, what percentage of water will ethanol stabilize at? Do you have any idea?
Well, alcohol and water are very miscible. They mix with each other very well. And it is possible to get alcohol that is pure alcohol, but there may be a few small percentage of water left in it. Will you have some potential use for it without the water, or...
No, I just wondered, you know, maybe the service stations are selling us a whole lot of water.
Oh.
Oh. Well, if they are, then that will that will have an effect on your engine, and it will produce a knocking sound that you can't miss. That's not only illegal and professional, but you should have a conversation with the gas station manager if you suspect that. Do you have reasons to suspect that?
Pardon me?
Do you have a reason to suspect that there is...
Oh, no, I don't think they're adulterating. I think that the alcohol would just pick up the water spontaneously.
Yeah, but the amount of water that's picked up spontaneously is very small. It doesn't contribute to what we're concerned with. No,
yeah.
No.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bill. Bob in Barneveld, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Yes, I'm enjoying the show. This is fascinating.
Thank you.
I had two questions, actually one sort of a comment, but the question was, there was an article in the Madison paper recently about the water quality in Lake Mendota. And part of it related to the value of having swimming pools around because of the condition of Lake Mendota. And I wondered if he had any information on that with respect to our local lakes and the places where we have recreation activities and the chemical properties there and what risks we're running.
The lakes in the Madison area are among the most studied lakes in the world. That's because of the excellent research facilities that we have at UW-Madison. In this case, it's the Limnology Lab. Mm-hmm. The late Art Hassler, started this way back in the 1960s. In fact, the Limnology Lab is named after him now. So they have a website. Actually, if you go to my website, I have a link to the Limnology Lab, and there's all kinds of information about the quality of the water in Lake Mendota, but also other lakes around the state, because mm-hmm. It's not only of local interest to us in Madison here, but elsewhere around the state. So if you go to if you just Google limnology and followed by Wisconsin, you'll get to the Limnology Lab. There are all kinds of information about it. And yes, the quality of water in the lakes requires a great deal of attention from us. And this summer we've had a lot of rain, and the lake levels
still very high.
Continue to be very high, which means there's been a lot of runoff. That means that aquatic life is going to be affected. It's not only those of us who enjoy the recreational aspects of living in the area where the lakes are, but it is the long-term ecological effect. In fact, in Dane County, there has been a serious proposal made to lower the level of the lakes. Now, that has a lot of consequences because it affects businesses that are around the lake, and then there are potential long-term ramifications to how much salt we dump in the wintertime to de-ice the road. Where do you think that salt ends up, Bob? It ends up in the lakes. And when you dissolve salt in the lake, then you affect the amount of oxygen that's available in the lake. It tends to lower that. So the Limnology website is just a great resource for information about this.
And you could either just go there or to your website. You have a link at scifun.org.
Scifun.org. And when you go to scifun.org, click on Chemical of the Week. When you click on Chemical of the Week, you'll find then the next link is called Lake Lore. Lake Lore, L-O-R-E. And it that takes you to that website.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. And we have some open lines. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Bob, you had a question about the school year, did you not?
Well, yes, I did. Just a quick thought to throw you away. I'd researched this in Illinois, but not Wisconsin. But I would be surprised if it was different. We cannot look at the current school year and decide it was always like that. We started out with school years in more rural times that were limited to harsh winter times. This is why many people attended school for no more than perhaps a month or two a year for 3 or 4 years and learned basic ciphering skills, and that's it. The school year expanded as our capabilities improved. We are at the point now where, as a more urban society, our school year almost goes well into, it does dig pretty deeply into the summer now, but it wasn't always that way. So the premise that the school year is focused on having been an agricultural society is right on the nose.
Yeah. I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls. Chris in Madison, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have a quick question, sort of a follow-up question to the question about fluorescent light bulbs.
Okay.
I'd read an article recently that some of these new flat-screen televisions and plasma and LCD screens can actually use as much electricity as a refrigerator and that it might be contributing to global warming. And I have no idea whether there's actual scientific evidence to back that up or whether it's just hearsay and speculation. I was wondering if you knew anything about this.
There are all kinds of ways by which we contribute to global warming. The primary way is the combustion of fossil fuels. But then you know, anything that produces heat, that puts us in the infrared region, and that contributes then to having this blanket that prevents radiation coming from the sun bouncing off the surface of the earth and going back up. So I really can't answer your specific question, Chris, because I don't know what's in that plasma on that TV screen. There could be all kinds of phosphors. There could be all kinds of different things. I'll tell you one thing. We have recently in my home, we bought a large screen, and that room is warmer than any other room in the house when the TV is on.
When the TV is on, so yeah. It does emit a lot of heat.
Oh, yes, it does.
All right. Well, that's one that we can probably look up and check out for you. I don't know about that one. I'll have to check on that. Linda in Eau Claire will give you a chance. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I believe the folklore about the Mad Hatter is actually because of the people who made hats, that is the hatters, had a process whereby they dipped the felt in mercury to soften it, to shape it. And that then led to the workers becoming mentally affected by the mercury.
Interesting story.
Yes, that relates to what I was saying. Yes, the way the hats were made and the way they were shaped had to do with the chemicals that were used. And, you know, Larry, mercury was used medically at one time to treat syphilis. And the cure effect was worse. Well, couldn't be worse than the disease, but it was a situation.
It was as bad.
It's just as bad as the disease. So yes. Well, thank you, Linda, for pointing out that connection.
I appreciate it. You can join in too. By the way, we have open lines now. We'll get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And email us at talk@wpr.org. And just a reminder, we've got a couple of pictures up on my website now of Bassam with his beakers. And he's shaking them right now for me and getting some new colors here. So take a look at our website, wpr.org, and go to Conversations with Larry Mueller. And you'll have a chance to see Bassam and see his beakers. And we have some more callers online. So we'll take those calls. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. And I think we got Jim up from Kewaunee. So let's go to Jim. Jim, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Earlier you were talking about the math scores of boys and girls.
Yes.
I was wondering how that showed up when they entered the university. If you were having more girls entering as chemistry majors, for example. I know when I went to law school after World War II, there was one woman in the law school, or one girl. Her name was Belle Phillips from Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. She was black, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was male. Today that has turned, or 60% of the law students probably are female. Is that same trend continuing into the sciences?
Yes, indeed. Not only into the sciences, the general population at the university, there are more women than there are men. But there's another side to this, and that is among the faculty, there aren't as many women yet as there are men. This is not a matter to me of simply counting. This is a matter of really making accessible to all talented people, making academic opportunities accessible to all talented individuals, male and female. And so I think that statistically it's clear that there are more women now in engineering and science in all areas, actually, than there used to be. That has not now reached the ranks of faculty. Now, if you look at the teachers at the grade school level, I think it is about even there.
About half and half.
About half and half, yeah. Although a long time ago, it used to be dominated by women.
Well, I have a son who teaches high school chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And his main complaint about the lady teachers in his system, and they're mostly women in the high schools today, he said that they equate poor performance on the part of the boys. If you don't do your homework, you're not just a poor student. You're a bad person, and he sees a real problem developing in these. He calls the boys the lost generation.
Well, it is happening not only, as you say, Jim, but it's happening elsewhere because there were many efforts, very worthwhile efforts, aimed at increasing the participation of women. Young women in academic endeavors, especially in science and engineering. And now we need to pay equal attention, the same kind of attention, to the development of talent among both men and women, both boys and girls. This is not to take anything away from the efforts that have been in place and are working to increase the number of women in all professional aspects of life. But this is a matter of paying attention, the same kind of attention to develop talent, whether it is in a young boy or a young girl, so that we all then benefit from their future contributions to our society. You know, basically what we're talking about here, Jim, is societal attitudes toward people. That's what we're talking about. And these are matters that we as a learned society, as an advanced society, should be able to deal with intelligently. Let me put it that way.
Where do you start doing something about it?
Well, we're talking about it right now, and I suspect that people in the listening audience are thinking about it, and I hope they're thinking about it. I hope they will talk to their school administrators about it. I hope your son will talk to the teachers privately, not in an admonishing way, but in a concerned way. So maybe the teachers that he is talking to you about would become aware of what they're doing and maybe change it. I'm very optimistic about such changes, but it's hard to change. It's very hard to change. And as you ask, you know, where do you start? Any opportunity that comes up, you know, you should just take advantage of it and talk about it and do something about it.
Yeah, I think there's more recognition of the fact that boys have... that there is this sort of gap that's going the other way now, and you see it in national publications, and I think there's more awareness out there now, but that has to sort of translate into action.
I think we have to do that, and awareness is very important, but the action, as you say, Larry, that follows awareness is even more important.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
I have five daughters who are older than my son, all of whom benefited by the notion that girls should be able to do anything.
Yeah.
And they have. They've become very successful business people. Several of them are multimillionaires.
I hope, Jim, that they now are encouraging youngsters, both male and female, to do the same.
They are.
That's a start. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Chris in Ferryville, I believe, is up with a question. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, gentlemen. I just thought I would pass along a little information about the recycling aspects of the fluorescent bulbs that are currently in use.
Yes.
There is a concerted effort by the majority of the cooperative-owned and investor-owned electric companies to have recycling available at most of their bill payment centers.
Mm-hmm.
And also most of the major retailers that are selling and providing the bulbs to people have a recycling available at their locations. There are special requirements for handling and also for cleanup in case there's any accidents. That information is usually included right with the bulbs. But most of the major retailers and almost all of the electrical utility companies have a recycling program available.
That's good to know, Chris. Thank you for sharing that. And once again, I urge all of us as we consider new products to learn about them and learn about the proper disposal of the old ones as well as the proper disposal of the new ones as the need arises.
And Bassam, we have about a minute or so left. Any last words for our audience today in the science area?
Well, I just feel it's such a privilege for me, Larry, to be on your program and to be able to communicate with the listening audience. I get so many email messages and people talk to me at airports, everywhere else. I just say the main theme that I focus on is truly the development of talent, because people ask me quite often, you know, I speak before different groups. They say to me, what business are you in, Dr. Shakashiri? And I usually say I'm in the education business. And then come on, really, what business are you really in? And I say, I'm in the talent development business. Sometimes they quickly ask, is that a for-profit or a non-profit? And I quickly say, it is for-profit. It's for the profit of everyone. And that's what we should really be focusing on. And because we're so blessed with so many resources, and we're blessed with great wealth in talent. We just have to develop it and sustain it and really think about the future and how all of us can contribute to benefiting all humankind, not only in our country here, my adopted country, but around the globe. And you know, Larry, this is the 50th anniversary of my coming to the United States.
Yes.
I've been here for 50 years. I'm very, very proud to be a U.S. citizen, and I'm dedicating myself, as always, to continue to be part of this movement to develop talent.
Bassam, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And, you know, Bassam always follows up. He always has little extra things from the show on his website. I hope you'll take a look at the website. There's lots of fun things to do there. He's got some experiments you could do with your kids or your grandkids. Go to, among other things, but take a look at www.scifun.org. So it's S-C-I-F-U-N. .org, and you can get some more information from Bassam and his crew in chemistry. Bassam Shakashiri is UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. He directs the Initiative for Science Literacy as well. And so it's always a pleasure to have him with us, and he will be back. I'm sure of that. We'll talk with him again. Well, we've talked a little about science. We're going to talk about exercising a bit, but doing it through hiking. There's a new book out. It's called 60 Hikes Within 60 Miles, and the 60 Miles of Madison. And Kevin Revelinsky, our guest, Madison author and hiking expert, next here to answer your questions on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.